we have in marketing. So I will tell you about the work that I've been working on recently in the last couple of years. And this concerns primordial neuroscientists. So using the neuroscientists that we can detect in the CNDN isotopes as a tool to discriminate basically among models of the early universe. So let me just give you a brief outline of my talk. First, I will give an introduction, discuss motivation and the observational status of younger scientists, either for the present or for the future. Then I will show you some of the tools that have been developed in the recent years to compute younger scientists. And then I will try to find some time to discuss the models. And the prediction of these models about the younger scientists. In particular, maybe I don't know whether I will be able to discuss all of this. I will talk about the curvaton, syngon, and multi-field inflation. Then other models of inflation, which do not rely on the slow roll approximation. And finally, I want to discuss the p-rotic because recently I've been involved in a project about it. So let me first start from an analogy about particle physics. Particle physics is very nice because we can predict very precisely things and we can compare them with experiments. In particular, there is a whole very developed machinery about computing correlation functions, using Feynman diagrams to compute S matrices, and then later cross-section that we can compare to the experiments, to the accelerators. Well, now the idea, and so basically the idea is that you have an action for a model, okay, and you know exactly what are the predictions in terms of cross-section, and then you compare them with the experiment. The idea is whether we could do the same in cosmology, whether we are able to starting from correlation functions in the sky, be able to determine the action of that describes the early universe, more or less. Okay, so this is the idea. The thing that we want to measure is a correlation function of something that is called the curvature perturbation, and I will describe it later, from which this perturbation are imprinted in the CMB. And then there was a sentence that James Taylor wrote us last week during his talk, which is the first sentence of Anna Karenina of Tolstoy. And that says, happy families are all alike, every unhappy family is unhappy on its own. And it applies also to non-Gaussian scientists somehow, because non-Gaussian scientists define as something that is non-Gaussian, so there are all sorts of non-Gaussian scientists, if you want. So the idea is also to try to understand what are the templates, what are the non-Gaussian scientists that we expect from a given model of the early universe. And in particular, I will be interested only in studying this three-point function. There has been study in the literature about the four-point function. In particular, claims that the four-point function could tell you something about the so-called FNL, the three-point function. However, these claims have been revised recently, and I think that the three-point function will be the most important tool to detect non-Gaussian scientists in the future. So in my talk, I will concentrate on it. So the idea is that if you see something here, then we have some primordial non-Gaussian. Let me first remind you, so you are a very general audience, I think, but there are very good experts about this subject. I will try to be both introductory but also detailed later. Let me remind you a constant. We know that the expansion in the universe fixes a length scale. This length scale is the Hubble scale, which varies with time. And in principle, during inflation or during models of the early universe, scale, the physical scale, L, will exit the Hubble radius, then remains outside the harbor radius for a long time, and then re-enters in the harbor radius during the radiation dominated era. So when I will talk, or during the matter dominated era, okay, in the later universe. When I will talk about a large scale, I mean a scale much larger than the harbor radius, and small scale, the opposite. Okay. So it's very important to understand what is the variable that we want to use to study non-Gaussianities. In this, there are some concepts that may be useful to know. The first is that when we look at perturbation scales which are larger than the Hubble radius, in general, in the equations that we use to study them, we can neglect spatial gradients. This is the base of the so-called separate universe approach or gradients expansion. And the idea is that the evolution of this quantity on large scales is proportional to H, so on large scales typically will be much larger than the gradients. Okay. So let us suppose that we have two regions of the universe which are separated by a distance which is much larger than the Hubble radius. So we can describe them by using a metric with a scale factor that depends on these two regions, and is different for these two regions. And let us suppose that there is a single fluid in this universe. And let us even suppose that we choose the time such that all these observers at constant time see the same energy density in the universe. Okay. Okay. Clearly, in this case, the history will be exactly the same. Okay. So the scale factor, in particular, will be exactly the same up to an integration constant, up to a constant which can be defined as also as a rescaling of the spatial coordinates. And this is exactly, on large scale, the quantity we are interested in. Basically, on large scale, this is simply an integration constant, but when we enter on small scale and the gradient starts being effective, this becomes a real dynamical quantity. And this quantity will become non-zero during inflation, okay, will be frozen, will be constant on superable scales after inflation. And then this is what we observe with CMB later on during the matter dominated era, basically. And you see, it's very important to have all this argument holds at linear order in theta, but also non-linearly. So this quantity is conserved at all orders, if you want, for a universe which is composed by a single fluid or by an adiabatic fluid, basically. And no, I don't think it's important. No. But the idea is that there is a single fluid, you see, that there is a single time. You can describe the time with a scalar field or a fluid whose pressure is a function of only of the energy density, barotropic fluid. Okay.
Only if Hubble goes to zero, then you don't have the
library. Yes, it's true that when Hubble goes to zero, this variable is not well defined. But I don't know whether this is just a question of a definition. Or
the tradition is not satisfied either.
I don't know if I think about the bouncing, the bounce, all the modes will tend to go out during the bounce.
Well, depends on how. You should also compare to H dot as well. If H dot turns dominate over curves, spatial derivatives, then you can still technically do.
My guess is that this is not the problem in the bounce, but if H goes to zero, yes, it is a problem. Yeah. Anyway, so the idea is that this quantity is a nonlinear
is a conserved quantity at all orders, and it's very important to describe an number of scientists by using a quantity that is constant. So we can forget about the history of the universe after this number of scientists has been produced, because this is constant and we are really saving. Okay. So, by studying this, the two-point function of this quantity, we know already several things. We know that the perturbations in the universe are mostly adiabatic, which means that probably they have been generated by a single dominant component. We know that they have a scaling barren spectrum. So if we interpret this in terms of inflation, this means that the Hubble radius was a slowly decreasing function in time, and the mass of the supposedly inflation field was more than the Hubble parameter during inflation. We haven't seen a gravitational waves, and tensor modes would be a very important discriminator between inflation, which predict some, at least some models, and other models that in general do not predict gravity waves. And then we know that this quantity is gauged to a very high force, okay. Much higher than what we think. It's very high. So the idea is to do something like what I showed you at the beginning for particle physics, although there are much many more complications in this case, especially experimental complications. So the idea is to start with an action describing some universe model. This action will be an action for a scalar field, for example. And then from this action, we can compute a three-point correlation function of the scalar field. Then there will be another, and this is already a source of number scientists if we have some nonlinear couplings into this action. Another source of number scientists will be the relation between this scalar field, which imprints the perturbation in the universe, and the actual perturbation that we observe. Okay. So this will be the two sources of perturbation. For example, if theta is a function of phi squared, if we take the point correlation function of theta, this will be sourced not only by the point correlation function of phi, but also by the square of the point function of phi. So it's important to know exactly this relation and this conversion. Then we are able to compute this quantity, for example, which is our observer, but actually not. Our observer will be the CMB. And this is large no man's land for the moment, in the sense that there has been a little work on this part, and this is what I think it will be important to understand in the future. There have been many people studying the generation of longer scientists from early universe models, also because it's much easier to do it, but this step is hard. Okay, so first of all, how do one measure a number scientist, and what is the level of number scientist? A way of parameterizing number scientist is in this local form, saying that the code of perturbation in real space is just a Gaussian part plus a chi squared part. We inform this factor called nonlinear parameter FNL. Okay, and this is just for historical. This also means that there is a FNL, it tells you how much basically the square of the power spectrum two point function. So it gives you the importance of the three point function with respect to the square of the power spectrum. Okay. There is another way of parameterizing number scientists that sometimes is easier to understand, which is completely dimensionless in the sense that if you replace theta by some dimensional field, this remains dimensionless. Okay, and it's just the comparing the three-point function with the two-point function the three alpha. Okay, in a way that this is dimensionless, and this is related to FNL in this way. I think maybe I just write it down here because we will use it later. So Ng is three points, okay, comparing to three points to the data. And this is to FNL, 10 times 10 to the minus 5. This 10 to the minus 5 is being the, simply the square root of the power spectrum of theta, no? 10 to the minus 10. So when I say large number scientists, very large number scientists are when energy is order 1. It means that the triple function is of the same order of the two-point function. Or that this term is much larger, is of the same order as this. Here, this is completely incompatible with observations for the moment. Small number scientists is when this term is of the order of this square. Okay. So of the order of second order perturbation, basically. And this corresponds to FNL of the order of 1. From FNL of the order of 1 below, second order perturbations in the Einstein's equations, for example, starts being equal. So if we start with the Gauss initial condition, there will be a growth on number scientists just because Einstein's equations are nonlinear in theta. And then if you want to detect an FNL at this level, or smaller than 1, you have to go beyond the linear theorem. Okay. So very small number scientists are FNL smaller than 1. This is actually also the limit, the experimental limit that we will be able to reach with the CMB. And inflation is much less expensive. So in principle, this FNL is very simple, it's a constant, but in fact, much of the models that we will look at predict an FNL which is in general scale dependent. So you can see FNL as a generalization, as a, some kind of this spectrum for theta. Okay. Just modulo is a square of the power spectrum plus the permutation of those. We know that if FNL is a function of this 3k, and there is a delta function here, so this k describes a triangle, basically, okay, because the momentum is conserved. And depending on the models and on the signal, the signal could be maximum for the squeezed configuration, so when one of these two this case is very small, it means that one of the modes is very superpolarized. Okay. And this is exactly the local case that we have discussed before when FNL is a constant. In this case, the signal is maximum for this squeeze configuration. And then there is an equilateral configuration, that means that the signal is maximum when the modes are approximately the same. Different models or different contribution to the models will give different local or equilateral configurations. Okay. So let us see what are the current bounds and the future bounds that we will be able that it will be possible to put on FNL. First of all, if you look at CMB, FNL, the bounds that you can put on with CMB depends largely on the number of pixels that we have. Because the larger the number of pixels is, the smaller is the Poisson noise, basically, you know, coming. So it will be proportional to the square of the number of pixels and also to this signal NG, okay, to this one. And this is related to FNL detect. So it's very easy to estimate from WMAP that has the order of 10 to the 6 pixels, we will be able. In principle, it will be possible to reach the FNL of order 11. Probably, Bond the other week said that in 2020 they will be able to reach an FNL of the order of 20. So, a bound of an FNL of the order of 20. So, clearly, these bounds that have been written down in this paper are maybe very optimistic. Today, we are at about FNL, I think, 100. A bit less. Planck, in principle, has more pixels, so we can go down with FNL. But even with an energy experiment, that is with an infinite number of pixels, we cannot go beyond the FNL of order about one. And the reason of this is because basically on very small scales, CMB is and the signal is that we have a silk damping, basically that derives the primordial signal and lower the signal of CMB. And furthermore, we have a lensing that increases the noise. So at some point, you will have a saturation. It's not possible to go beyond that, at least with the CMB. You see that with a two-dimensional survey like CMB, the number of peaks is proportional to the most, to R max, maximum number of that you can have to the square. But if you had like a three-dimensional survey, we would have many more pixels, okay, in principle. And if you don't have this silk damping effect, there has been a claim in the literature that one can reach a FNL of the order of 0.01, or other people said 1, using 21 centimeter survey, which is the detection basically of the photons coming from the spin feeding in the near hydrogen before ionization. But nobody has ever observed one of those lines, so we don't know if we'll be able. But in principle, it's not a question of cosmic variance, it's really a question of reacting with. Maybe there will be other theoretical limitations, but for the moment, they are not known. Okay. So now I go to the question of computing the number of scientists. And so what I would like to show you are the technique that has been developed recently in order to compute the frequent function of, for example, of a scalar field of the photo perturbation. And these are very similar to the technique, I don't know, Mukanov for the linear perturbation, for the amplification of our perturbation that has become so standard in cosmology. No? And I think these techniques have become standard in the recent years because of the paper on Maldaseda, basically, and the other pages that have followed. So just to start with the simplest example
is to take a test field in a quasi de Sitter universe. So take this kind of metric, with A is an exponential of HT and H is a slowly decreasing function, and to write down the action second order, okay? Second order in phi. So a test field does not mix with gravity. You can forget about the gravitational perturbation in principle. All the perturbations are in this field, basically. So a standard way of studying the amplification of vacuum fluctuation of this field is just to say that this is an operator, write down, expand it as as eigenmodes of the Hamiltonian in terms of annihilation and creation operators that satisfy commutation relation. This is the solution of the classical equation that you derive from here, and basically what you obtain is the standard law. No? So you generally normalize the fluctuation, so phi classical, when the modes are well inside the Hubble radius, so that they feel like they are in Minkowski, basically. And then when they exit the horizon, they will have a scale invariant spectrum, a spectrum which for k much smaller than this, so we can forget about this. It will have a scale invariant spectrum. And the fluctuation of phi will be proportional to H, basically. Okay, this is there. So if we want non-Gaussian, everything here is linear, and therefore it will be Gaussian. The fluctuation of phi are Gaussian, no? Because there was no non-linear interaction in the action. Okay, let me say something. So when we write down this, exactly, and for this reason, when we write down this expectation value, we mean that they are taken over the vacuum of the free theory, so without any nonlinear interaction. If we want non-Gaussianities, we have to go beyond that. We have to put something, nonlinear interaction. No? Sometimes the model predicts which nonlinear interaction do you have. So let us put it simply v cube phi cube, so without derivative terms for the moment, simple like that. And let us see what are the number of scientists given by this term. Here we suppose that v cube is smaller than h, because otherwise you can go, you have problems with perturbation theory. And now what we want to compute is the correlation function of phi cube. So this is an equal time correlator on three different points, in principle, no? Three different points in space. And this correlator means over the vacuum, the ground state of the interacting theory, so the theory that contains this interaction term. And in principle, we know how to handle, we know from perturbation theory, quantum field theory, we know how to handle very well these quantities that are the field for the Gaussian theory, for the free theory, and the vacuum of the Gaussian theory, of the free theory. So the theory that we described, basically this, no? So the idea is to try to rewrite these quantities in terms of this. And this is something that is very well known in perturbation theory. With the prescription, and the prescription will be that the free theory is recovered when you get very inside the Hubble radius. So you will have the free theory when you go basically in Minkowski, when you feel the fields that you are in Minkowski, you know, here, basically, during inflation. So the expression that you find for this three-point equal time three-point correlation is given in terms of this time evolution operator, which is written in terms of an interaction Hamiltonian, okay? Exactly the interaction Hamiltonian that we have. So what is doing this is the time order in T. What is doing this operator is the following. Okay, here you see this time T is the same time that we have here. So what this operator is doing is taking with this, is taking the free field at a certain time, bringing it back to minus infinity, where it was when it was very well inside the horizon, and it was filling the vacuum, and then it's propagating it. So this is with the free Hamiltonian, basically, okay, and propagating it with the full Hamiltonian containing the interaction Hamiltonian in time. Okay, so in this way we can compute the in expectation value, and this is different from computing a scattering amplitude, which is more like an in-out. Which basically your vacua are defined in the asymptotic past and the asymptotic future. This expression has been given by Weinberg recently, but there is a vast, Andrew is an expert on that, so if you want, you can ask him. There is a vast literature on this in-in or Schwinger-Kellish formalism that was used for quantum field theory at final temperature, I think, and in different contexts. The fact is that Maldacena used this expression, but only at three levels. So you can find it by just taking the first order term in the Hamiltonian interaction here and here. Okay, and he found this expression. Okay, this is a big technical, but I think it's important to go over, and you will see why. And the idea is that this expression, since it is at three level, in principle you can also find it by just studying the nonlinear evolution of the field, okay, but treating the field as an operator, and then normalize it in a proper way in the vacuum on smaller scales. You can simply take the evolution equation of phi, write down the solution in terms of retarded Green's function, and then you see that when you want to take the three-point correlation function of this, you take three of this, which is this one, which is basically zero because this field is Gaussian, okay? And then you will take two of this, and this quantity, sorry, plus permutation, and if you arrange these operators, you obtain exactly the same expression as Maldacena. So you can see it from a particle physics point of view, but also from a more cosmologist point of view, in the sense that you just evolve non-linearly the field. Okay. Okay, typically there are three contributions that one gets from the expression of Maldacena. You have an integral here, it comes from integrating in time the solution of the free theory, okay, this three solution of the free theory on three different modes. And the integral over times, when the modes are well inside the Hubble radius, will give you a zero contribution, basically, because they come from very small scales when the modes are heavily oscillating, and this is exactly corresponds to the vacuum, and you don't have any contribution to the three-point function. Then you will have most, then you have times corresponding to the crossing of the Hubble radius, okay, corresponding to when HA is of the order of this three Ks, basically. And this we can, and the contribution that comes from here, you can call it, for example, quantum contribution, because it comes from close when you are still inside the Hubble radius, although very close to the Hubble crossing. And typically, they will lead to non-Gauss entities which are of the equilateral configuration. Okay. While everything, all the integral that is on later time is due to the nonlinear evolution of the modes on super Hubble scales. So we typically have a local configuration. And you can call this a classical contribution, basically. Okay. Then, of course, when you compute a three-point function, as I said at the beginning, this is not the end of the story. You have to compute the nonlinear relation between phi and theta. So in order to know the non-Gaussianity of theta, you need also this non-linear relation. Okay. But basically, in a signal of non-Gaussianity, you will have typically two contributions, and sometimes this is absent, or sometimes this is really negligible with respect to the super Hubble evolution of modes on non-linear evolution. Okay. There is a rule of thumb to compute the non-Gaussianity. And basically, this is the follow. If you have an action, let us take always the same example. If you want to compute the quantum contribution, so the contribution coming from the modes, coming from a Hubble crossing, basically, it's enough to compare the operators, basically the nonlinear operator, with the other operators, the kinetic term, for example, at energies of the order of the typical energy of your problem. In this case, for example, it's H. No? So this will give you, in general, this quantity Ng that I wrote down initially. For example, in this case, one expects an intrinsic non-Gaussianity of the field that is of the order of V cube, then H cube coming from this one, divided by H to the 4, which is H squared times 2H coming from the fact that the H is dotted. Okay. Anyway, if you do accurately the calculation with the Maldacena expression, you will get this times some K dependency, okay, which is non-trivial, of course. And in general, this as I said, this quantum contribution leads to an equilateral, leads to a signal which is larger in the equilateral configuration. Why? Because we are taking the scales in this problem at more or less the same, no? Which is at around H. Okay. Then what follows? So when you are on super Hubble scales, you can just simply use the classical evolution of the field. For example, in this case, since we are considering a slow rolling field during inflation, this will be negligible with respect to the Hubble damping. Let's suppose that the field is massless, so the non-Gaussian contribution to the field is very simple to compute with this. It's sourced by this nonlinear term, so it will be proportional to V3 over H squared, now one H here, one H here. times the number of efforts during which the field has evolved. For example, times the number of efforts between the horizon crossing and the end of inflation. Okay. And this is a contribution that will be there. For example, in the curvaton, if it has a nonlinear coupling, there will be such a nonlinear evolution. Now you can ask, well, it's very strange because if I take a delta n to infinity, this non-Gaussianity will go forever. In fact, you have to be careful when you go, when this becomes larger than unity, you have to take into account higher order terms in the expression of Mal-Lassalle. In principle, this is just to say that if you solve this classic evolution, okay, non-perturbatively, you will just find a non-perturbative expression. And when you just take the series of this non-perturbative expression, the first order of the series will be this one. And then there are corrections that you have to take into account. Okay, so this holds only when this is small. But this is just the classical evolution. There is nothing more. Okay, and typically the classical evolution leads to a signal which is higher in the squeezed configuration, so in the local configuration. Okay. Furthermore, as I said, we have to go from the field perturbation to the zeta, to the perturbation in the curvature. And to do that, it's useful to use what is called the delta n approach that has been, for example, discussed last week by Misao Sasaki. As we said before, we can take our metric on large scales, okay? And as we said, we can consider this as a scale factor per turb. And if we take the number of efforts of these scale factors between an initial flat hypersurface and the final hypersurface defined on an equal constant, and the final equal constant. Constant density hypersurface, the perturbation of this number of e-fold, okay, between this flat hypersurface and the constant density hypersurface, and the unperturbed, basically, value of this number of e-folds, gives you exactly the theta perturbation. Okay. You can just, basically work it out from this expression, if you want. And the crucial point is that this initial hypersurface, if we are during inflation, for example, depends only on the value of the fields that you have in your problem. Like during inflation, this will be your inflatons in the problem. So if you have, if you know exactly how n, so the background evolution depends as a function of the background field, if you know the first derivative and the second derivative, you can, in principle, compute the theta at late time, so when we are here and when it becomes constant. Saying like that, it seems very simple, but in fact, it's very difficult for a general model to compute this perturbative expansion. So what Sasaki was saying was a part of the story. In fact, it's not always simple to compute this quantity. Okay. But in general, this is a tool to describe the relation between theta and your fields. Okay. How much do I have, Zach? 20. So let us start. Since I have discussed a test field, I think I can start directly from the curvaton. Because the non-Gaussianities generated by the curvaton are very similar to the non-Gaussianity of a test field. So what is the curvaton, first of all? The idea is that maybe the field responsible, let's suppose that the field responsible for the superluminal expansion that we have during inflation is the inflaton. Okay. So the field that dominated inflation. But maybe the perturbation generated from inflation were small, And there was another light field during inflation that acquired the scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations, and that later on, after inflation, dominated the universe, imprinting its perturbations. How can it dominate the universe? Well, the idea is the one that at some point when the mass, when H drops below the mass of this curvaton field, then this curvaton field starts oscillating at the bottom of its potential. And if we can approximate the bottom of its potential by a quadratic function, then during this time, the curvaton behaves as a non-relativistic particle, basically, as a non-relativistic condensate, and starts dominating the universe because it goes faster. The energy density increases faster than the energy density of radiation. At later time, of course, it has to decay, and if it gets sufficiently, and if its energy density gets sufficiently important before decaying, it can imprint its perturbation. There are three contributions to non-Gaussianities, and again, these are those that we have seen before. If the curvaton has a nonlinear potential, there will be a contribution due to this nonlinear potential at Hubble crossing. And then this nonlinear potential will be active also during inflation, and in principle also during the radiation dominated era, although this contribution is small, but it has been computed. And then another important contribution that everybody has computed is the relation between sigma and theta, because the curvaton perturbation depends on the energy density of the curvaton, and the energy density is a quadratic function of the curvaton. So there will be a nonlinear relation between these two. So let us estimate all these contributions. Well, the first contribution comes from computing a three-point function of the curvaton field at Hubble crossing. Okay. This, in principle, will be negligible. We can also set this to zero if you want. The other contribution comes from the nonlinear evolution later on. We neglect this during the radiation dominated era, and we add the contribution coming from the nonlinear evolution during inflation, okay? With this delta n being the number of ifolds between Hubble crossing and the end of inflation. So basically, we have, when we get to the moment where the curvaton oscillates, we have a nonlinear relation between the perturbation of the curvaton and the perturbation of the curvaton at Hubble crossing. Then there is a nonlinear relation between the curvaton at oscillation and the theta. And again, we can estimate this by using the delta n. So we know that n behaves, that the scale factor during the oscillation of the curvaton goes like the energy density goes like a to the one third. No, the energy density of the curvaton goes like one over a to the cube. Okay, so the number of ifolds is just the difference between the logarithm of the scale factor at the moment of oscillation and at the moment of decay, and this one third comes from here. And then you have to re-express the energy density of the curvaton at oscillation and at decay in terms of its expectation value. If you do all this, it's a bit complicated, but you obtain this expression. So the R here is basically the energy density of the curvaton divided by the energy density of the universe at the moment of decay. So in principle, if it dominates completely, it's one. Otherwise, it's less. And here you have the contribution coming from the nonlinear potential. And these contributions are, and this one here, are intrinsic to the relation, to this relation, to the, okay, to this relation. Now, of course, you have another constraint that you have to take into account, is the fact that the curvaton field has to be light during inflation, so V cube has to be smaller than H squared, basically. So V cube contributes to the effective mass of the curvaton, and this has to be small. Okay. So this will not give you a too large contribution. You see that SNL can become large if R, only if R becomes a bit small. So it means that if the curvatron do not completely dominate the universe, then we have a large SNL.
For the power spectrum itself, that's the amplitude is just h squared.
Well, yeah, if the interferon perturbation summary is on. Okay, let us. I will. No. If the curvature perturbation from inflation are negligible, you will feel only the power spectrum on the board. If you are referring to the fact that you may take into account loop corrections to the... No, this is what you're saying?
No, I'm just wondering, just delta rho over rho, if it comes purely from the curve, the input does the fucking decay there?
But, no, I say, this is in the case that the input is not. But if the interferon contributes, you have to adjust your...
No, sorry, I wasn't talking about it, so I'm just a two-point function.
So there are cases in which the interferon and the curvatron contribution are of the same, can be on the same order. But these are very special cases. And this corresponds, I think, when the vacuum expectation value of the curvatron is around the mass Planck. This is the case that have been studied actually by me. And David Knight one, but this is a special case. In general, what the curvatron is nice for is when it really dominates all the perturbations. Yeah. Does it belong?
No. No, I'm just, sorry, I don't want to, maybe I'm being stupid because I don't understand, but delta rho over rho normally is h squared over epsilon, where epsilon is the Stroll parameter, but here you're...
Ah, no,
you're
here it's completely different, so,
it's
yes.
Just going to be h squared.
No, no, it's cool, it's cool. So, zeta is cool. For inflation, it's this, no?
No.
That's right. Now, in this case, it's a bit different. It's something like delta sigma over sigma.
So sigma is a word and not its h.
I think one over no, sorry, I think times star. So typically it's yes, h r over sigma, but the message is right. So it's easy to make it that because the sigma maybe is more. But okay. So let me go on to, I think I can quickly discuss inflation and then we'll discuss the theory.
Okay. Just one more question. Yes. So basically the intrinsic free point correlation is very small.
But it is
like less than.
Ah, yes. You can estimate it, but it will be, so first of all, it will be proportional to the nonlinear cap. So if there are no nonlinear couplings, it's completely negligible. For example, in your case, there will be a nonlinear coupling. Right. And then they will be completely undertaken by the growth. So basically, they will be given by more or less this term, but without that time. And that time is 60. So it will be very small.
So it's only dominated by the local.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's always dominated by the local. And this is because the potential, this nonlinear potential that we have taken, is do not contain derivative terms. Okay. For example, during inflation, it's different if there's only derivative terms. So when we talk about slow roll, we talk about weak couplings. We know that slow roll conditions, so imposing that epsilon defined like that. And this second derivative of the potential on the interflaton field are small, means also that you don't have a very strong nonlinear couplings. So if you have very strong nonlinear couplings, inflation lasts very short. In fact, you can estimate this as being of the order of epsilon squared times the amplitude of zeta, and if you remember, this was exactly the NG for a scalar field, and this means that we would have an FNL of the order of epsilon squared. coming from the intrinsic potential, nonlinear potential of the inferior. So the number of centers will be dominated by other things, for example, by the presence of gravitational perturbations. In fact, the inferior is not like the test field. There will be gravitational perturbation which will mix with its own perturbation. What does it mean? It means that if I take this curve, for example, this will contain perturbation of the field plus the metric, which contains the perturbation of the field itself. Now, the idea is that if you expand the disaction at second order in the perturbations, you get the free theory, like the Munkanov of the standard machine of the 90s. Okay? And the idea of Madasena has been to expand this action at third order
and to find the interactive theory, to find the nonlinearities that are present in this action. But maybe it is convenient, although the calculation is very much similar, to use this gay choice, so to use theta, or let us put it in another way, to go into a gauge where the time corresponds to the equal phi, to the constant phi hypersurface. Okay. In this case, all the perturbations are concentrated in my theta variable. Then if I expand my action at second order, I get the usual action of a scalar field. Again, as you see here, the scalar field has no mass because theta is a constant, is constant on large scales, so a constant is conserved, on large scale, so a constant has to be a solution of this equation, so it's a completely massless field, and then with the usual machinery you get the standard spectrum of fluctuation with this epsilon here, which was exactly this that we discussed before. Now, what Maldacena did was to compute, to expand this action at third order, and to consider also the other interaction. Again, as you see, this interaction contains only, there is never a terms without derivatives, just because theta has to be constant, has to be conserved on large scales. But another consequence of that is also that when theta crosses the horizon, then the growth of nonlinearity stops. So all the contribution to non-Gaussianity comes, in fact, from the horizon crossing, okay? And from the relation between the inflaton field and the theta. But now we are already in the theta gauge, so just from horizon Hubble crossing. Then there will be in this action other terms, okay? But these are in general suppressed by Slow. So, for example, if there is a cubic term of the potential of the inflaton, this will be a term which contains order 2 in Slow. So it's completely negligible. We can compute NG with the procedure that we discussed before, so by comparing these operators with the kinetic operators of zeta here. So there will be here, there will be epsilon squared. There will be typically H squared coming from this dot, and 3 zeta, and here there will be it's this, so 1 H, etc. And you find this quantity. So this already tells you that FNL will be of the order of epsilon. Okay. In fact, if you do carefully the calculation, you find that FNL is ns minus 1 in the squeeze limit, apart from a factor, I think. So it is generally very small. Ns is the spectral index of the fluctuations. But the nice thing is that this is completely model independent. As we said, whatever enters in the potential is suppressed. So it comes only from gravity, and it's a very sharp prediction of inflation. Okay. Then one can repeat the same thing in the case in the multifield case, and Siri Lizzi did the calculation to compute the correlation function of the fields. If you have an inflationary phase with many fields, no? Correlation function of the fields at Hubble crossing. This is again model independent because it will largely come from nonlinearities of the gravity, but then zeta, when you have a multi-field phase of inflation, keeps going also after horizon crossing, because you have isocurvature modes. Okay, so you will have a nonlinear growth after Hubble crossing. And in fact, you can estimate, and this will be model dependent, and what we did with David Wons is estimated this growth for the case of a separable potential. So in general, FNL will be given by something which is which comes from a Hubble crossing, and it's model independent. It's given by R, which is the ratio between a tensor and scalar, which is known to be small. Okay, and then something that but generically, I think for slow roll will be always small. So in my opinion, all slow roll models or inflation leads to small non-Gaussian. So let me just skip to the ekpyrotic, okay? So to say, ghost inflation was a model where you don't have a slow roll, you still have inflation, and the typical non-Gaussianity that you find are all distributed in the equilateral configuration. So having said that, it's just to say that if you want everything distributed in the equilateral configuration, you need a model which goes beyond slow roll, like DBI models or K inflation models, or for example this ghost inflation. Okay, in the case of the ekpyrotic, so I remind you that in 2001, Justin with Horvath, Steiner, and Turok proposed a model of a collapsing universe dominated by a scalar field with an exponential potential like that. Okay, this evolution during this collapsing universe was very slow, in the sense that this C that is here is very large, such that this power in the power law is very small. However, it had problems in producing a Selimar spectrum. In fact, at theta has generically a constant mode, which is the one that stays constant on super Hubble's case, but also a varying mode. And this is a growing mode during the collapsing phase, which is transferred to the decaying mode in the spanning phase, okay? And is therefore unobservable. And this is the constant mode, which is transferred to the constant mode in the standard evolution of the universe, in the expanding universe. However, this in this model was blue, thus incompatible with observation. However, recently there has been a rebirth of this model when these people realized that if you use two fields, one of these fields can get a scale invariant spectrum, and this can be transferred in very much a way similar to the curvaton perturbation to the theta variable. And the idea is that one can look at this problem. So these fields have always exponential potential. One can look at this problem by making a rotation in field space, such as the evolution of the universe is along the phi field. Okay. And this happens when we have a regime called of scaling, in which both these fields, these fields' energy density are important. This is called the scaling regime, and during this phase, the field the chi acquires a scaling invariant spectrum. And the origin of the scaling invariant spectrum is the fact that if you rewrite the potential of these two fields by expressing everything in chi and d phi instead of the original fields, you see that the chi field has a negative mass, which is exactly this one. Okay. And this is the origin of the scaling invariant spectrum, if you want. This phase of scaling is unstable, so you expect that at some point you go to another phase which is dominated by one of the two fields. Let's suppose in this example that we go to the phase dominated by phi 2, okay, with this scale factor. So you go from this. Okay, this is just to say that you can study the generation of the amplification of quantum fluctuation of delta chi, and you can obtain a scaling invariant spectrum, which is this one, just because of the presence of the mass, which gives you these two here. No? And this scaling invariant spectrum will have a correction coming from the expansion. Sorry for yes, which gives you in this very simple model a blue spectrum. Okay, so if we have two potentials like that, you will have inevitably a blue spectrum for the perturbation of theta. However, you can play with your potential to obtain a radial spectrum, but you have to tune and to introduce other parameters. Here we have only two parameters, C1 and C2. Okay, let us go to the study of non-Gaussianities. First of all, non-Gaussianities will be largely generated on large scales from superbubble evolution. You can estimate the subbubble generation, and this is completely negligible. So you can simply study the large scale evolution of the field chi. In the potential of chi, there will be non-linear terms, exactly like the V cube that we have studied for the curvaton. And these non-linear terms will give you some non-linearities in the evolution equation for chi. Okay. So you can find the solution of this equation, and this will be given, okay, sorry, this non-linear term is proportional to C tilde, which is a combination of C2 and C1. So everything is determined by this C2 and C1. You can find the solution of this equation. This has a Gaussian part, which is alpha times h, and the nonlinear part. Alpha here is, in fact, a non-Gaussian, sorry, is a Gaussian variable. And now we have to estimate how much is the theta, how much is the curve of perturbation after the transition to the phi 2 dominated phase. And to do that, we use the delta n formalism, simply by knowing that in this phase, A varies with this power law, and during this phase, A varies with this power law. Okay. So it's very easy to estimate n as being a constant due to this growth, plus something that depends on h at the moment of the transition. So what we are doing is the following. We are starting from a flat hypersurface of constant Hubble parameter, and we can do that because chi is an isocurvative field, so do not affect perturbations, no, basically. So the Hubble parameter equal constant hypersurface, it will be flat, will be unperturbed. And then we stop exactly on a rho equal constant per surface, on a uniform Hubble parameter or density per surface, but we make a transition at a certain value of the field, so on a uniform field per surface. And as I said, n trivially depends on time, and this 2 over C1 comes from taking the difference between this and this, basically. Okay. So you expand this n in alpha. You find the nonlinear relation between h at the moment of transition and alpha, and you obtain this expression. Since you know that alpha is a Gaussian variable, you simply obtain the value of the non-Gaussian. No, it's not through the bounce. It's before the bounce. Yeah, and then you have to assume that theta is conserved through the bounds. This is what everybody does. Okay. You see, I think yes, because the conservation of theta is a consequence of the conservation of energy momentum tensor, of the continuity equation. If you
think that this is fine, I don't see. Well, okay, we could discuss for a long time whether it's correct or not. But
well, the question is a long wavelength condition satisfied or not?
But a long wavelength, yes, in principle, yes, because the monster keeps going out of the horizon, and they start going inside the horizon only during the radiation and after the interview. So in principle, so what you see is that FN is proportional to C1. So it can be very large depending on the value of C. And as we said, at the beginning C has to be large to have a slow evolution of the collapsing phase. But there is some kind of tension between wanting it to have an FN small, which leads you to a C small, and wanting it to have a spectrum which is as close as possible to scaling bar, because we know today that a blue spectrum, spectral images of scalar fluctuations, is not really viable. So wanting C1 to be large. But apart from that, it's not the model is not all up, so we expect from and it can be tested. Although unfortunately, in this simple model, it leads to the same prediction of the quotient in a way, local prediction, so it's difficult to distinguish between that.
So let me conclude. Sorry if I go too late. So I hope that I have convinced that non-Gaussianity is a useful discriminator among early universe models, especially because slow roll models are really give you a model independent signature, which is very small non-Gaussianity. So if you don't see anything, or better, if you see only the nonlinear effects coming from gravity, let us say, probably slow roll inflation is well justified. There are other non-slow orders that lead to large non-Gaussianity of the equilateral configuration, like DBI and Gauss inflation. And Couraton-like models and non-Gaussianity can be large, it will be of the local configuration, and this will be similar to the Pirotic, where non-Gaussianity is large, and you have this tension between the non-Gaussianity and the spectrality. Okay. Thanks.
I have a question about curvatography. So I would expect that so to get large amount of Gaussianity, you have to have R to be small,
How much? R?
Yeah,
yes.
R have to be small.
Yes.
So I would expect, though, that the sigma star, because it's a light field, scaling inflation,
is over the edge.
Or as minor. Or
is that? Why is that? I expect that it's about the age, because typically these are the fluctuations that it has a light field during the time. I don't expect that that is, but I know that is a square. This is going to be about the age. So.
Yeah, I guess it depends.
If it is about the mass Planck, as I said.
I guess it depends what you call natural, right? Because I agree the quantum fluctuation would be order of h, but then the energy density, let's say estimated as m squared sigma squared, then if sigma is of order h squared, and m squared is much smaller than h, then you mean this field initially has exponentially small energy density.
Yeah. This is, yeah.
Well, okay, in any case, the point I wanted to ask is that. Is that it seems that if you make little r small, you're also boosting the tensors, right?
You boost them down.
Yes. No, tensor to scalar. So the tensors would be order h, and then the tensor to scalar would be proportional to one. I mean, the usual little r is proportional to this.
Yes, but so typically,
it doesn't seem easy to get FNL of order 100.
No, I'm sure that you don't boost, because somehow this theta is a.
No, here R I think is the ratio of the two energy density.
Yeah.
I want the curvaton decay, not just.
Sorry, I'm
not. Parameter that has to do with scalar ratio.
I understand, but still, what we normally call R, the tensor over scalar, will be proportional to 1 over that little R. And his FNL was also proportional to 1 over little R.
No, but he can have an inflation in very small h, but it's still the comparable energy density of the two components.
Sorry, so the length of the scalar will be about h or m and Planck.
How is sigma star?
Somehow I'm a bit very confused here.
So it goes as if the sigma star or R.
Yeah, I suppose not.
Anyway, it's not such a big. It's just that it seems hard to get a large one to have a Shannon being there.
Because you wouldn't, but I'm sure that you don't see much. You see that because the amplitude of the ether concentrations are very small. So these parameters are in such a way, in fact, that sigma star has to be much less than mass Planck. This is very small. Otherwise, you get, if you want this large, then you get too much angular symmetries. Sorry, small, then you get too much angular symmetries.
Can you just say again, remind us what you meant by a local configuration? Does it mean two out of the three
yes.
points are near to you?
Exactly. So it's when one of the scale, in a real space gets very, very large. Or one of the k gets very, very small, so you can squeeze the configuration. And this comes from typically from superarbol evolution. Similar to a rescaling of the coordinates.
So can you apply the current FN elements to the Ecola configuration at all?
So the limit that I have discussed, not. But there are people like Caminelli's and Laiaga who have done a similar analysis for the FNL in the equilateral configuration. The numbers that you get, if expressed in terms of FNL, are different. But if you express them in a more independent way, it's just the same amount of longer signs, basically. Depends the way you express them, but in terms of FNL, well, you can do that, yes. So there are typically there are certain patterns, certain template, if you want, that you can analyze the idea is to make this or the models to fit these templates. Okay.
So would the local one be harder to observe because of you need a better resolution to see it? Or?
No, I don't think that the local one will be harder to observe. Certainly, in the local one, it means that you are mixing very small scales, so you are looking at on one side, a small L, and in the CMB, for example, small L, and then a very, very large L. So, but in any case,
it's very large L, it's
difficult. But in any case, the maximum signal is where you can get a lot of the maximum constraints are on very large L because you can increase the number of pixels that you have in your CMB spec. So also for the equilateral configuration, you will have to go to very large. So it's not that much different.